you look at this, and I thank John and Anna and Ready for this invitation and everything. It forced me to go back and think about how we do some of the things that we often take for granted in terms of just looking at this overall system. And so during this whole talk, what I'm going to do is kind of challenge you on ways to start thinking about how we bring pieces of information together. Because, as John mentioned, is that there's a lot of issues about how do we begin to look at this system relative to precision agriculture. How do we look at it relative to decisions that we make in agriculture? Because if you begin to look at this system and the agricultural system in general, as we look at it, there's a couple things that come to mind that I'm going to start off with, and that is that we're going to have to continue to improve our food production system tremendously in order to meet the food demands by 2030, 2040, 2050. The thing that people fail to realize in that whole effort is that we're not going to change the amount of precipitation that exists on a worldwide basis. So it means that we're going to have to use water more efficiently. We're going to have to figure out how to put more water into that crop productivity from a different standpoint than what we've been doing. And so I think it really challenges us as agronomists to think about how do we utilize soil water, how do we understand the dynamics of soil water, and how do we begin to put that into new decision frameworks that we go forward. And we see lots of technology out there, and you see a lot of that throughout the whole morning when we talk about different remote sensing techniques, different stress indices, all the utilization of remote sensing, and I'll bring all that together. So we're going to start off just by talking about sampling design framework. I'll roll through some of that. There's some individuals that I work with in the lab, Tom Sauer, John Pruger, Christian, and Ken are two postdocs that we have working on different aspects all the way from the energy piece to the whole aspect of how aggregates change right at the soil surface. How do we change the soil by what we do in a lot of this? So when I began to think about this, and when John and John asked me to do this, went back and started thinking about what sort of questions do we really often overlook, or sometimes we address, but what information does soil moisture data help provide to make that decision that we want? And then how fine a resolution is really needed? We can do all sorts of things in terms of monitoring, but is that really appropriate both at the spatial and temporal scale that meets our requirements? And then how accurate is that? And so you think about those questions from that perspective. It really gets into saying, how do we begin to think about our soil moisture framework? And so I started off with this simple one. And this is building a decision framework. And it really is about what's the moisture content in the seed zone, because it's all about planting. And if you look at it from that standpoint, you say, what's it take to put that seed into the ground? If we've got dry conditions, and we're going to end up with a poor stand. If you've got wet conditions, you might end up with a poor stand. The optimal condition somewhere in between, you get this excellent stand out there. But the soil moisture sensor that producers use is just feel. They just go out in the soil and they look and everything else. And so we often overlook the fact that a lot of our decisions are made by our eye and how it feels rather than any sophisticated technologies. And if you look at this, and I'll just divert a little bit, because as we work with vegetable producers in California and Arizona, that's the technique that they're often using. They're irrigating, they're looking at it, saying, you know, what does my gut tell me about the conditions that are there that I get that stand up in the least amount of stress possible to that plant? And so their soil moisture sampling framework is nothing more than look and feel. And we have to realize that there are a lot of decisions that are made that are right at that level, that we're not building sophisticated tools. We need to help them understand what that dynamic is from that standpoint. The other piece of this, now I'll divert into where we get a little bit more complex in all of this, and I'll just look at this from the standpoint of field capacity, the root zone, and productivity. And we've seen this curve over time that there's a certain amount that we can change a lot of dynamics within that soil and extract water out of that soil profile. And once we reach a certain breakpoint, then productivity starts declining. The question is, knowing when does that breakpoint occur? When do we move from optimum, suboptimum production? If we're in irrigation systems, how do we assess that fuel capacity? That seems like a relatively simple question, correct? But what goes with that? You have to understand that what fuel capacity really means relative to that plant. A shallow-rooted crop, much different dynamic than a deep-rooted crop. Fuel capacity means everything in terms of looking at the depth of the rooting system that's out there. If you look at drip irrigated systems rather than sprinkler irrigated systems, if you look at drip irrigated systems in terms of field capacity, just by the nature of what we do in terms of drip irrigation, we've limited that root zone. We've limited that root zone. If that drip system fails, we can change root capacity or field capacity very, very quickly and put that plant from optimum to suboptimum very quickly. If you've wet the whole profile and you've got this deep, expansive root system out there, there's a lot more forgiveness in what that fuel capacity means. And so the question really becomes of how we assess fuel capacity in a lot of this. So the question is, if you look just relative to that simple graph out there, is how much in advance do we need to know when that breakpoint begins to reach? Applies to irrigated conditions. Rain-fed conditions, what are you going to do? You may know that you're reaching that breakpoint, but in rain-fed conditions, all you can do is hope for rain. How much variation exists across the field in different soils? When you really begin to think about this, is where do we measure that field capacity? How much variation in time exists in that soil water status relative to field capacity? And so not only is it a spatial thing, it's a temporal thing. And does effective field capacity change with the growth of the crop or among crops? And if you look at this, and I'll just use one example in this as looking back to some of the things that have been asked to do lately, is look at turf grass. You find out that the tolerance of turf grass isn't about how they're using water. It's about the depth of the root. And so drought-tolerant turf grasses do nothing more than expand the root zone, so they change their effective field capacity. Shallow-rooted are very, very sensitive to water stress because they have limited root capacity or limited root volume that they're taking water up. And so you look at that different dynamic in all of this and thinking about how it's changing. So we need to think our definition of what is effective root capacity or what is effective field capacity in a lot of this and begin to understand just some of these dynamics of what's going on. So we need to go back and think about just some of the basics in a lot of this and think about what that soil water balance looks like because we've got precipitation and irrigation as inputs and we're losing it by either ET, runoff, drainage, and that balance is out there. And so we have inputs, we have outputs in a lot of this. I have to go back and look at this for you because if we think about the rate in which that system is using or changing the soil water balance out there, it's just the components of net or ET out there. You've got net radiation, you've got the water vapor gradient, you've got a wind speed gradient. But the throttle in all of this relative to ET is what the soil water availability is. What is that water availability within that system? You're going to hear some talks this morning that talk about how we monitor crops and their crop water use indication. But that final box out there, soil water availability, is the difference between potential and actual evapotranspiration. And the plant really cares about actual. It doesn't really care about potential. Actual is really what drives that overall system when we think about that. So what is that soil water availability? How's that plant getting it over time? And you often have to realize this, because now when you start looking at the scale relative to precision agriculture, is that all fields are not created equal. All soils are not created equal within that field. And so it really becomes a point of how do we look at a field, and this is just one of our highly instrumented fields. We've went through and we've mapped with the NRCS data. This is just that one parameter of water holding capacity on the different soils that you can extract out of Surgo. And so you can see you go all the way from 327 down to 266, 60 millimeters of difference in the upper and lower ranges across that whole field, 60 millimeters, and roughly if we use 6 millimeters a day, that's 10 days difference in water use or available water to a corn plant in Iowa. So that's 10 days is a lot of difference in a lot of this. And so we need to think about that particular aspect. And so when we really begin to think about this, the question is, how do you sample that field? How do you sample that field? Because this is a production field. And I can tell you producers don't like a lot of wires. And they don't like a lot of things that obstruct any of the management equipment that they put across that field as well. Just to give you another piece of this, is that soils are not equal, and you see this difference in soil water holding capacity because this is a study that we ran in 2002. This is eddy correlation equipment. This is flux data across. We ended up with 14 fields across Iowa on corn, carbon uptake, and cumulative VT uptake. Those differences that we see in the fluxes out there are due to soil water holding capacity. And so what we saw, and we had the world's most fortuitous experiment there because it didn't rain in one part of the watershed and rained in the other. We never could have planned that experiment that way. It just happened to be that way. And so what we see is that a lot of cases there, and when we look at yield rankings at the end of this whole season, is those yields fall out as well because those plants weren't stressed when we got the high ET. And you see all the different carbon uptake as well. So I think when we start looking at soil water, we have to realize what that soil water is being used for and how that's placing into this whole idea of where we need to look relative to productivity. Going back to this theme of all soils are not equal, there's just two different photos of soils out there, a nice soil out of Iowa and a little poor soil out of the southeastern United States. As we look at that upper root zone in this is just NRCS photos that you can pull off their photo gallery, illustrating the point that when we start looking at that field capacity out there, a lot of it's determined by how we look at what that water holding capacity is in that upper part of that profile. But more importantly, when we look at the soil water balance, it could be in terms of even how well that soil is infiltrating water. And the soil water dynamic is not just dependent upon what's stored in there, but what gets in there. And I think we need to think about a changing definition on soil water. It's, and I tell producers, that it's not how much rain is in the rain gauge, it's how much rain is in the soil, because that's what determines our productivity. And so we need to be thinking about how we manage our soils to improve our capacity that's out there. And if we get into this whole aspect of soil water monitoring, we have all this technology, and there's been tons of information that's been written on everything from the gravimetric neutron probes to capacitance to microwave sensors and all of this that you see. So we don't lack technology to be able to do this. What we really lack is how do we effectively apply that technology to our soil moisture systems. And I really think that becomes our challenge. Analytics. And I even put field back up there because a lot of, like I said, a lot of our decisions are made that way. If we just look at temporal variation at a single depth, and this is just a 10 centimeter depth from the whole planting season, growth season across one of our cornfields in central Iowa. 10 centimeters, you can see that change, very rapid change that goes back and forth. As we go from rainfall event, we extract that water out, we evaporate water off the surface. So the question becomes is what sort of temporal variation do you need to be able to understand that dynamics out there? If you're sampling once a week, you're going to miss a lot of points. And so if you really want something shallow, you're going to have to be very fine in terms of the temporal resolution. And I just added now the 100 centimeter depth to that as well. You see the 100 centimeter depth, early season is not changing much at all. Finally, late in the season, when we hit a dry period, we begin to extract water out of the 100 centimeters. So temporal variation at the really deep depths, entirely different time scale in terms of how it's responding from that standpoint. And then I just put 2016. We had some rain events, we had dry periods. See the whole difference between 10 and 100 as well. And so when we start looking at this and we see this, this is just a dynamic of depth over time, beginning of planting season on May and the July 31st, because in 2015 we actually added water to that profile because we had some excessive amounts of rain over this field. In 2016 we went from wet to dry because we had a really long dry period, like no rain in the whole month of June on this field. So you begin to understand the dynamics of what's going on from that standpoint. But then I also started thinking about just what do we really represent within that field. It's not just about how many soils there are within the field. So I looked at a gravimetric probe and said, all right, if we're going to take a 2.5 centimeter or 1 inch core out there, and we took 10 cores per hectare, that's 5 to the -7th area out there. We're kidding ourselves and thinking just how much do we really represent when we take a soil sample out there. It's a pretty minuscule aspect of what that soil looks like in all of this. And we have done all sorts of soil sampling where we've sampled at 5 meter grids around there, and you find all the variation that exists in that. And you look at this, you know, and you really begin to understand the dynamics of what's going on from that standpoint. Even if we took a capacitance probe and said we have an effective radius of 10 centimeters and a length of 20 centimeters and the upper volume of 1 hectare, it's still 6.28 to the 10 to the minus 6th area, or volume of that. So we're even with our capacitance probe, we're not representing a big area across that, and we can see all sorts of different pieces. So we have to realize that when we sample our soils, these methods don't represent a large fraction of the soil matrix. And so that leads me to the point that if we asked our simple question of how we were going to sample X, and if we sampled at X, how likely is that representative of that whole field? And now we're going to have to get into the point of saying, how do we begin to look at this from a different aspect of field dynamics? And we sample with depths, and just those 6 depths give us sufficient spatial resolution. And what if we only sampled 2 depths? What if I sampled that soil that I showed you in contrast with this one, where we have high organic matter only in the upper 2 inches and clay, heavy clay below that? You know, what do those 2 depths represent? And so we need to start asking some different questions of when we put it into this decision framework of really what this means. So the question when we start looking at this from the standpoint of effectively using water and effectively looking at changing water use efficiency from my viewpoint is, what soil type are we going to use as an indicator? Are we only going to concentrate on that soil as well? Do we use the dominant soil within that field as the guide in all of this? Or do we use an integrated approach based on historical observations? We've sampled a lot of fields very coarsely and very finely across there, but I don't have time to go do that spatial sampling that's often needed in there. So it leads me to the fact that we have a lot of tools at our advantage. We have tools that we can start looking at spatial variation so we can do a different analysis of really what it looks like. And you'll see some more of those talks today in terms of remote sensing. And I think we begin to utilize How do we look at this system from a different perspective? How do we begin to apply and fuse different data together to look at this? Not only our soil water sampling, but the spatial variation that exists within this field. This just happens to be Sentinel 2 data across Iowa on the end of September. This is a high resolution. It's a 10-meter satellite that gets data every 10 days. But I think there's another piece of this that we can use, and that's the SAR data as well. And I think there's some real advantages of how do we bring visible near IR with SAR to start looking at spatial variation across fields. So we start utilizing remote sensing to help guide our sampling decisions. How do we look at what really is occurring within that field as well? This just happens to be some brightness temperatures. This is an experiment that we ran in cooperation with NASA. This is SMAP, the soil moisture satellite that was up, is up. This happens to be aircraft data, brightness temperatures. You see the variation that exists across fields. And just to put it in perspective, we can map it. This happens to be the SMAP data from November 2015, looking at microwave soil water content across there. And so even on a global basis, we can start looking at what our soil water status is, at least in the upper surface as well. So in this design framework, and these are the challenges for you, is that we do have tools to quantify the spatial and temporal variation. We've built those tools over a number of years. I mean, we've got neutron probes, capacitance probe, resistivity. We've got microwave at the surface out there. But it really becomes a challenge of how do we apply the right measurement for the decision being made. Getting back to that productivity piece, how do we really look at this in a temporal scale? How do we look at it in a spatial scale? How do we take this information and begin to improve the efficiency of crop production? And I do believe that this last piece is where we're going to have to start focusing on, is that we're going to have to start thinking about concepts that fuse multiple sources of data. We just can't look at one piece of data anymore. We're going to have to look at multiple pieces of data that will increase our confidence in our sampling scheme, but also increase our confidence in the decision that we're going to make, whether it be improving productivity, improving the whole dynamics of the system that are out there in many different ways. And so I think the challenge for us over the next few years is really think about how do we begin to integrate spatial and temporal information together in ways that we haven't done before, but also begin to look relative to the production system and saying, how do we take that information and put it into improving the production efficiency so that we can get it to the point in which producers can really begin to use it. So with that, thank you.